Ugly Duckling Oboes is dedicated to the development of young oboe players. They provide quality handmade oboe reeds, private lessons, and high-quality oboe sales, rentals, and consignments. The oboes that they rent are conservatory mechanism oboes that include the left-hand F key and low B flat key. All are maintained by oboe-specific technicians. In-person lessons are available, as well as virtual lessons for students who live outside the geographic area or have transportation and scheduling challenges. They also offer online college audition coaching for high school juniors and seniors who plan to audition to be music majors. Visit uglyducklingoboes.com for more details on how you can set up yourself for success and sign up for their newsletter. That's uglyducklingoboes.com.
Consider buying your processed oboe and bassoon cane from those friendly folks over at Barton Cane. Processed with care and precision for your everyday reed-making needs. Take the pain and injury out of reed-making by letting Barton Cane do the hard, repetitive, boring stuff. Free up time for practicing, happy hours, hikes, baking, and spending time with friends and family. Barton Cane, here for you. Visit www.bartoncane.com.
Hi, I'm Galit Kaunitz.
And I'm Jackie Wilson. And you're listening to Double Reed Dish,
a podcast for oboists,
bassoonists,
and the people who love them.
I feel like I've just seen you.
Oh my gosh. How long has it actually been? We saw each other Sunday morning and it's Thursday now, just 4 days ago.
What a luxury.
Yes, we were just together in Dallas, Texas. I've never been to Dallas before. Had you?
I have been very briefly a long time ago. When I was a student at UT, I drove out there to have a lesson with Aaron Hannigan. It was fantastic, but I don't remember much about the driving in Dallas, which
the traffic,
I remember now.
The traffic and everything seems so close and you're like, oh, I'm looking at the map and it looks fine. And then it's like, oh, Google Maps lied and they said it would be 22 minutes and it's been 50 minutes and we're in the car emailing our accompanist. Many sincere apologies for whenever we will happen to get to where she is.
And she had already planned for that, by the way. She was like, don't worry, I cleared my whole afternoon. I knew y'all were going to be late and stuck in traffic.
The locals know better. So we're bearing the lead. Why were we in Dallas?
We had the pleasure of attending the UT Arlington Double Reed Day. It was DRD at DRD.
That's right. I was like, wait, they're UTA.
We were hosted by Melissa Bosma, Laura Bennett Cameron, and Jasmine Trujillo, and it was the best time.
They had a step and repeat.
They had a step and repeat, which Jackie had to explain to me what a step and repeat is.
And to be fair, I only know what a step and repeat is because of Jill Zarin, one of the original housewives of New York City. A step and repeat is the signage that is behind on a red carpet. So when people are like showing up at an event and it says like, I don't know, Doctors Without Borders, Louis Vuitton, and they stand in front of it and they like have their picture taken, that is called a step and repeat.
Well, now we all know, and hopefully there will be one at every event we attend from here on out.
Well, there was one at UTA, and you and I had fun. We had a little photo shoot. Like, I think we were supposed to be heading to something, and we just, like, grabbed one of the UTA students and was like, here's my phone. Take some pictures real quick. And we were, like, posing and whatnot in front of the step and repeat when we were definitely supposed to be teaching. But yeah, we had the most amazing time. They have a young artist competition. So we got to hear and adjudicate so many phenomenal young musicians.
Amazing young musicians.
just one of those situations where you're like, I wish we had as many prizes to give out as people participating because everyone's fabulous. We had an opening recital.
Let's see. We did a Double Redish live show, which was so much fun. So much fun. Everyone got really into it.
Yeah, the enthusiasm. That was the most hyped crowd we have ever given a live show in front of. Like,
so funny.
They were like screaming. Like, it was so fun. It was so high energy. Oh my gosh. That was just such a blast. And then, yeah, ended the day with this amazing large double reed ensemble. And then you and I went out to a local restaurant.
And had the most amazing guacamole we've ever tasted.
Y'all, okay, listen. So we order this guacamole and we were like looking at each other and we were like, oh my God, this is really good. Then the waiter comes back and he's like, I brought you more carrots and celery because I felt like y'all needed more. And it was like, oh, we wolfed them down in like 2 seconds. Thank you very much for bringing us more.
And they were like, we were like, while you're at it, could you bring us another order?
Yeah. And then we're like, another round, please. And so we had two guacamole appetizers after this double read day and just caught up and had so much fun.
Yeah.
It was the best. But we're burying the lead. The real excitement of the trip was a hotel that shall not be named. We don't want to be sued for defamation or slander.
This was wild.
Okay, I booked it. Like, the hotels were expensive.
Here's the thing, though, is it looks fine on the pictures and
the room
reviews.
Was fine.
Yeah.
It was very nice. It was a very nice hotel. Nice. Mm-hmm. And we didn't pay like $30 a night, but Dallas area hotels were expensive. And so, we were using podcast funds, so we were not staying at the Ritz-Carlton. I looked at the reviews and the pictures, and I found something that I thought was a nice, safe, clean compromise. And then you picked me up and updated me about the situation. How would you describe it?
I think, as I was driving to the airport, I was running the speech in my mind of what I would tell you. I was like, what's the word that I would use? Interesting?
We ultimately decided tacky was the best.
Yeah. It was like, you know, those motels where it's like two strip buildings, like a strip mall, and all the rooms are accessible from the outside.
Yes.
It was that. But they had renovated it, so they had built a giant roof over the entire thing. So the lobby was formerly outside. It was gigantic. Yeah. It was like we were in an airplane hangar, but it was the hotel lobby.
Yes.
And the pool, which was obviously formerly outside, was in the lobby now. And it was just like weird. It was so weird. Luckily, the rooms were fine. The rooms were absolutely fine.
The decor was very shimmery, glittery.
Yeah, it was interesting.
So we were like the very first night we were like, okay, like just getting our bearings, like, okay, not ideal, but we feel safe. So like, whatever, we'll stay here. Turn down the hallway and there is a gigantic cockroach.
Which...
dead on its back in the middle of the hallway, which Glee was like, that happens in the South. Like that doesn't mean anything. Like sometimes bugs get in. And I know like where I live, sometimes mice get in and it's not a reflection of cleanliness or anything like that. No. I understand that. Am I used to seeing it? No. Did I gasp and feel the adrenaline surge? Yes. Did it make me feel more confident and happy about our hotel situation? No. I was like, oh, God, there's a dead cockroach. Help me, help me. And it's also like, okay, like fair enough, but get rid of it. Why is it in the hallway? Come on.
It was there for a really long time.
It was there for a minute. It might have died from old age. From being in the hallway for so long.
And then, okay. So we stayed there 3 nights.
Yes.
Every night there was...
Well, we should say, because we haven't given the context of every night there were people in formal gowns.
Hummer
limos in the parking lot. And at one point, we just pulled someone aside and we're like, why is everyone in formal gowns? And they were like, it is a 50th birthday party and it's a multi-day extravaganza. And we were like, okay, so please continue.
Yeah. So we were like, that's great. Congratulations to whoever just turned 50. It's wonderful. Meanwhile, every single night, actually, no, the first night was okay.
The first night was fine.
The next two nights, there were teens running up and down the hallway all blessed night, slamming doors.
Slamming as if it was their objective, as if they were in a door slamming contest for the highest decibel level achievable over and over for hours upon hours upon hours.
I called the front desk so many times.
The first night it was like, oh my God, this is terrible. But we didn't really know why. Like, we didn't have an explanation that first time it happened on the second night. Then the third night, our last night there, we were going back to our rooms and we see a teen in front of us.
In formal wear.
She enters a room and you look at me and you go, the lock. So like the thing you can fold over the door, the metal thing piece. To like add additional security. They had done that before the door closed, so basically to be a stopgap
to keep the door from closing.
So they don't need hotel keys to go between each other rooms. And you go, they're running between each other's rooms, and so they would go from this person's room to that person's room, and the weight of, because the doors are weighted in a hotel, and that door would slam against the metal, and that's what was causing it so loud. And you look at me and you go, it's gonna happen again tonight. And I was like, it's going to happen again tonight. And sure enough, all night.
We called the front desk so many times and they're like, we'll send someone up. That was a lie.
Well, and they were making so money off this 50th birthday party. Like, it was the entire hotel and then you and me.
Yeah.
I heard them say multiple times, like, we're full. And so they were not going to make these guests mad. Like, but so I got through it by, I was like, I'm downloading a white noise app. I turned it up, like, as loud as it would go, which was too loud to sleep. And then I took two thick hotel pillows and I sandwiched my head in between them. And that muffled the white noise. And between those two variables, it only sounded like the door slams were coming from down the hall, not in the room with me.
Amazing.
What did you do?
I had my AirPods. So I put my AirPods in my ears and I turned my audiobook on as like loud as was tolerable. And I just tried to sleep that way. And that was the only way that I could sleep.
I feel like I'm still catching up. Sleep-wise.
It was so crazy.
Yeah. Yesterday I got an email. Please tell us about your experience at unnamed hotel. And I went, cracks knuckles. Here we go. Never was there such a bad review. Oh, but you know what, Dallas? We love you. Hope to be back soon. And
we'll pick a different place to stay, I think.
Yes, we'll choose it. We'll maybe get like a recommendation from a local who can guide us.
If you book a hotel near the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, look for Jackie's review.
Chemical City Double Reeds is a full-service double reed shop specializing in the sale of instruments, cane, accessories, and sheet music. Double Reed Dish listeners can enjoy free shipping with code DRDISH, all caps, no spaces. Visit them in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or online at chemicalcityreeds.com.
Hey, oboists! Have you ever found it difficult to sort out when and how to find a new oboe or English horn? Oboe Chicago streamlines the process, providing personal and professional consultation and a large selection of lovely instruments. The process feels comfortable and thorough. Selection includes F. Leray of Paris, Howarth of London, Covey Oboes, and Fox products. For a current listing of Oboe Chicago's selection, please visit www.obochicago.com. For a credit of $100 toward shipping, mention Double Reed Dish when you call or email Shauna.
We are delighted to welcome to Double Reed Dish, Henry Ward, Principal Oboe in the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can we start off by getting to know your journey on this instrument and how it started? How did you begin to play the oboe?
It's a long story in some ways. When I was a kid, my grandmother was a piano teacher. And I started taking lessons with her when I was like 5-6 years old. And she noticed right away, oh, wait, there's something, some talent there. And so she made sure to find me a good teacher. Fast forward many years to like age 12, I was in this boys choir in Philly. So I'm from the Philadelphia area originally. And I joined that choir, and I was doing a lot of like touring and concerts, like a really full concert schedule, including being in elementary school. So I really enjoyed that a lot. I was also a good piano player, but it didn't quite make sense to do that professionally, like down the road or for college. So I picked up the oboe at around that time because no one else was really playing it in my school. Pretty standard story in that regard. So I could read music and everything, but I didn't really understand how to play the oboe. Even though you know how to be, do know what music sounds like, it doesn't mean you can play it through the oboe. So it was a long process, but that's kind of how I got started with it. Yeah.
Do we ever truly understand how to play the oboe?
I'm still figuring that out. It's going to, yeah, maybe when I'm like 65, I'll know, but probably not. So.
Did you have like an aha moment where you said, oh, okay, I want to do this for my career?
You know, it's funny. I don't think I did. I think I, from a very early age, because I was in that choir, I kind of like wanted to do something in music. I didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but there was even, I remember like I was going through like my elementary school yearbook. It even says in there, what do you want to be? A musician. So like very early on, yes, I knew very early on that in some degree, whether it was teaching or performing or something, I really didn't see any other direction for my life. So, yeah.
Can you talk us through embarking on your educational journey and like where your training was, who your teachers were, that type of thing?
So I'm from southern New Jersey outside Philadelphia. So I had great access to teachers. So I studied with David Schneider. He was a big Philly freelancer for beginning to up until junior year of high school. That was like 5 years or so. And then I studied with Jonathan Blumenfeld, the second oboist of the Philly Orchestra, for my senior year. So like we were getting pretty serious at that point. So I was deciding to do this, and I had a lot of support, and I luckily got into all the colleges I applied to, which was four of them. So I had options, and I think people were surprised by that, but I'm happy that it worked out the way it did. So, yeah.
Where did you end up going for your college?
I went to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston for my undergraduate degree. Did that 4 years. Then I went to Roosevelt University in Chicago I didn't finish that degree at the time. I did finish it in 2020 during COVID on Zoom, right? It's very similar times right now on Zoom right now. Did a whole semester of that with lessons. It was actually great to go back to college like 15 years, 12 years later or whatever. It was great to actually like have lessons again and figure out. I don't do this very well still. Let's work on this kind of thing. So I did get my master's finally at Zoom University in 2020. So
that's so cool. What an awesome mindset to just like, hey, we're in this pandemic. I'm just going to go back and finish my degree.
Yeah. Well, it's awesome. They let me the school like let me everything transfer, so I only had one semester to go. So I was like, why wouldn't I do this? There's nothing else going on right now. I can actually do this. Why wouldn't I just do it? So we were actually performing at that time in Buffalo, but I was able to kind of juggle. It was actually a busy semester, like altogether, but yeah.
So, can I assume that what kept you from finishing initially was auditioning and embarking on your professional journey?
So
Could we hear about that?
I left that after the third semester of my master's to go. I were moved to Auckland, New Zealand, actually, and I played with the Auckland Philharmonia for about 2 seasons in an acting position. But it was kind of like, why not? I'm 24. Why not go and have this amazing adventure? So it ended up being, it was only supposed to be like 4 months, and then it turned into 2 years. Long story, but yeah. So I ended up doing that, and then I came back to from New Zealand 2 years later, and I then got into New World Symphony. So I then did that. So I didn't really, the timing never worked to finish that degree at the time. I always had the intention of doing it, but it never had like the flexibility or the time until we did, and and I did it in my living room, so it was even better. So.
Okay, so keep going with that and tell us about your journey to your current position with Buffalo.
Sure. So yeah, New Zealand, 2 years. I did a small 1 semester degree at Carnegie Mellon right after I got back. So it was actually kind of good timing. It was a 1 semester like certificate. There were no classes. There were no like requirements except lessons. And I literally just spent all day making reads, all day practicing, just trying to get myself more into shape the way I needed to be. I really had no life. It was nuts, actually. But it was really helpful. I was actually, it kind of was a time for me. I was like 26 at that point, and I was like, if I want to do this, I gotta think a lot about this a lot and spend some time. So I got into New World from there, did New World for about 2 years. During the second year, I was starting to play a bunch with the Pittsburgh Symphony in a vacancy they had. And I ended up being there about 18 months myself. Didn't win the audition, unfortunately. But then I was unemployed after that for about a half a year. And then in some ways, it was a really nice time because I could kind of do what I wanted. It was nice. But then I won the job in Buffalo soon after that. So like I've been lucky. Like there's definitely a part of this is definitely luck for sure. And I happen to be on the right side of it. And I think I did all the work I needed to do to get it. So I think I am very grateful for my job every day I go. So yeah.
We've spoken to a lot of players over the last 6 years, and I feel like not every path, but many orchestral paths are kind of, school and then auditioning and then getting that workplace experience. And you had the benefit of this experience in Auckland and then the New World Symphony. So you kind of started off with relevant professional experience of doing the job. How do you feel like that informed your audition preparation as you were kind of looking to the next step?
Yeah, no, I definitely had a zigzag like trajectory in my life. Yeah, it's no doubt have helped a lot. But at the same time, I mean, I'm sure we talk about auditions all the time on this podcast, but auditioning for a job is not the same as playing the job itself in a lot of ways. I mean, there are many similar aspects, but a lot of it comes down to if you can play well for 10 minutes by yourself, and you can prove that, it doesn't mean that you can do that in the job, play for 2.5 hours doing that. So it's a really, you have to kind of retrain yourself to play that audition in a different way. So it did help, but at the same time, that half a year I had of school after being in New Zealand really was really important to me to think about, okay, how do I make myself sound the best I can in 5 minutes of playing? Like, how can I do this? And I really couldn't. It was something that I had to really think about a lot and kind of get into a different focus. But of course, all the work I was doing was no doubt helping me, but it in some ways, having that free time to just kind of sit down and really focus on this process that we have to go through to get a job, that was more the what I needed at the time. So
So it seems like you went through a lot of transitory periods where you were living in New Zealand and then you went back to school and you had New World. And did you have to develop any sort of like mental strength and fortitude in order to stay sane during those times of impermanence?
oh yeah. So I lived out of two suitcases essentially for that whole time. First of all, that not that that's just a side note. But that in alone is a lot of mental stability too. besides that, yeah, it was. I had to really think about the fact that I was playing in these places, but they weren't hiring me full time. Which again, it's not. It's all good. But I had to think about like, I had to think about saying. Yes, I had to be very strong. I had to believe in myself very strongly, in a way that I know I think I have a voice in this field. I think I have I think I have the talent. I just need to keep trying. Rejection after rejection after rejection. Like you have to keep moving forward and thinking about, okay, what's the next thing? How can I make this even better than what I just did? It doesn't matter what the result of whatever what was kind of thing. It's more important to think, okay. I did fine. What can I do better? Let's make a list. And I make a lot of lists all the time, actually. So, yeah. So, yeah.
Could we actually hear more about that? So you said, playing in an orchestra is different from winning an audition. Can we hear some of the techniques that you implemented and strategies you utilized in or in your audition preparation, especially as approaching your Buffalo Phil audition?
Sure. Again, that's I will do my best. It's hard to work to make words with it sometimes. It's a lot of different. It's a lot of focus for sure. It's like it's a sort of like, for lack of a better word, it's kind of zen. It's kind of like you have to kind of just think about being kind of calm with what you're doing. After all, okay, I'm stepping ahead. Sorry. Preparation. You have to prepare over 100%. You have to be so well prepared. In every aspect of every excerpt and every concerto you have to play, you have to be able to sit there or stand there and play everything in not just in your sleep, but when their life is not great, you have to be able to play this as best as you can, kind of thing. Because that's how it's going to be when you sit in the audition. You're going to be nervous. You're going to be thinking everything's going to be bad. So you have to kind of get past that. You have to prepare yourself so well so you don't. Feel that way when you actually play the audition, which you're gonna feel anyway. So then you play the audition, and it's very. I kind of feel like in a way, I try not to think. I try my best not to think about everything that's gonna go wrong in the audition itself, because if I do, it will happen. In some, even if I don't think, even if it doesn't actually happen, I'll still feel like it happened. Like if I want to play. The Le Tombeau de Couperin between 8 and 9. I know the high E's in the crack. But no, it's not going to. If I roll prepared, it should be fine. So things like that. So it's more just about bringing your best foot forward and not being afraid of making mistakes about, but really trying to bring what you can do musically the best possibly what you possibly can. Like. I try to go back to like, what am I actually doing with my phrasing? Is it coming across the way I want it to come across? A lot of times it's not the case. So I have to go back and think about what, when I play, how is my playing being perceived by others? That's a big thing I think about. And not about mistakes. Like some, my best auditions I ever played, I crashed and burned like really bad. So it's really, and I don't have a reason. I think otherwise things are going well, except for that one major mistake. So I don't think it was really a habitual mistake. It was just a thing that just happened. And that's something that's what I'm trying to say, actually. It's like I'm trying to get rid of the habitual mistakes that everyone does is prone to make on these instruments, which the kind of the test of this process, I think. So it is an athletic event. I think of it as Olympics in a lot of ways. Like it's really about the 10 to 9.9, 9.8. It's like who gets the highest score or whatever. So
Yeah.
I love the de-emphasis of perfectionism, of like trying to just have the goal of not making a mistake, because I've fallen into that trap so many times, and you're one never happy with it, and no one likes it. No one else who's listening likes it either.
Yeah, I've never, I will never play a what I call a quote unquote great audition. Like I will always have like I remember I played my concerto a few weeks ago with the BPO, and I had to go speak to some kids after, and it's some musicians, some of that youth orchestra kids, and I went to them and I even said to them like I just played this, it went great. But I still have, I could give you 2 pages of things that I didn't do well, like that kind of thing. And that's just kind of how it's always going to be as a musician. So, what you're saying, yeah, I think that we are human. We are not supposed to be like a robot could easily do a perfect performance, but that's not the point of it. So.
Can we hear about the day and process at which you won your current position?
It's been so long, it's hard to remember exactly what happened. It's like it was like 9 years ago at this point. Yeah. So that audition, that yeah, the well, the nice thing about that audition was that it was a concerto of your choice for this audition, which was so I picked the Marcello second movement, which I love, and I can play it. It's one of the things I know I can do well. So
That's such a cool choice.
yeah. And I wanted to make sure, I think I even asked them, like, is that okay? And they said, that's fine. So I remember starting with that. And I think that helped me a lot, actually, being able to play that. I should have, like, I don't have, like, notes about it. I really should. I should have, like, taken notes afterwards. So I usually do take notes after auditions, but I think I was so, like, flustered the whole time for that one. So, no, it was otherwise, it was just a standard, like, concerto of your choice, and it was very basic, like normal excerpts, like kind of thing. But I actually, yeah, it was a. I think I must have gone well enough. So again, but I remember leaving it thinking, not sure, we'll see. But yeah, so, but
Did they declare a winner that day?
we did trials then at that point, and my trial was Alpine Symphony. So that's what we played. And then the trial went another week after that, and w which I did not realize was going to be the case until I was there. And that was a funny week because BPO, the Buffalo Philharmonic, does this guitar concerto competition every couple of years. And that was the second week of the trial. And basically, you don't know what's being played until the night before the rehearsal. And it was a list of like 7 or 8 concertos by for guitar, of which I only knew the Rodrigo concerto for the big English horn solo. I knew nothing else. So I like spent like I think like the whole night, 2 nights before or something, learning all these pieces. And I'm glad I did because the ones we picked were the ones that started with oboe solos, of course. So, and it had like a million solos in it. So, I mean, I'm glad I spent time on that. So, really obscure stuff. But then the thing is, the orchestra, we play this all the time. And so we're like, it's just like a normal day for us now at this point. But for me, it was like, oh, interesting. Okay. So, yeah. Yeah. But I think that's, yeah. And then I got the job then. And yeah. And it's been really fun ever since. Yeah.
That's a great segue into how has the job, doing the job, been different? So, was even your perspective as doing a lot of, temporary positions over the years before finding your permanent position, how has it been different from that?
Yeah, it's funny. The first thing I would say is that I am principal, so I am the one that's like the one leading the section, the whole woodwind section. I had to kind of think about that a little bit because I was always in places where I was not permanent, and I didn't really want to like step on any toes and all these things. And I kind of had to like be more of a leader kind of thing, and that was something I had to really think about a lot. It was never like talked about at work, but I just realized, oh wait, I need to kind of show myself like this is I needed to be very clear in my what I was doing musically and cueing and everything, just making sure that I was connecting with the front of the orchestra with the conductor, plus and translating that well into what I was actually playing. That was something I had to kind of have a quick learning curve on, even with my work as playing in other places. But yeah.
It's kind of related, but now several years into your position, what would you say makes a great principal oboe player?
That there are so many things, but I mean, like, and sorry, I'm not answering this question very well. Great principal oboe. Someone who has a voice for sure. That like simple as that. What does that mean? Someone that's easy to follow, someone that is flexible, someone that can be flexible when needed, and also kind of being a leader when also needed, depending on the music. Someone who can make my heart melt, kind of thing. It's like all that gooey stuff, all these great solos. You want someone who can really tear at your heartstrings and all this, and like Don Juan and among other many other things. Also needs to be a great colleague, kind of thing. That's a big part. Like being able to work together with everyone is really important. So, anything else I want to say? No, I think that's what I strive to be, at least. I don't
And then
always.
related to that, what do you look for in a second oboist?
Yeah, second oboist is a very important position. Needs to be very glued to the first oboe in a lot of ways, but also still needs to have a voice itself. So that position's more of a leadership position than people realize in some regards. Still, like you, it's it when there's a duets with the oboe, first oboe, it's kind of important to be listening, etc. But it's also you don't want to be playing too soft or too loud. You want to make sure that the second oboe should be very aware of what's going on in general between the whole wind section, making sure to balance things as well as they can. And also someone who has a good low register. That's always really important. I actually really enjoy playing second oboe, so I whenever I get a chance to do it, I do. I think if I as long as I have a read that will let me do it well, I'm happy to do it.
Related to what you look for in a colleague, what have you learned through being on the other side of the screen and listening to auditions, oboe and otherwise? It seems in higher ed, I learned more about applying for jobs by being on search committees than I did applying and winning jobs. And it occurs to me it's very similar. So I wonder what thoughts and advice you have for our listeners who are still on the audition path, looking for their next position.
So I've sat on several auditions, not a noble one here, but I've sat on several, and it's a really at the really at, same as my side of playing auditions. People can like have horrible mistakes happen. As long as everything else is really and is what we like, we will still vote this person through to play another round, et cetera, et cetera. It really comes down, I mean, especially in the preliminary round, it comes down to very simple, basic, like rhythm, intonation. Like it really comes down to silly things like that, which may not be how the person plays normally, but it's just how it was played that day, and that's just the name of the game. But I'm really, for me, sitting on the back on the other side of the screen, I'm really trying to find a true musician. That's like the first thing. It's not really about, I mean, people always talk about sound and things, and they want the specific sound. I'm trying to keep my ears out away from sound, and really trying to hear the music and see, because again, it's day by day. The person can easily change their sound if they need, if requested, kind of thing. But so people get so crazy about that. So I really try to hear, okay, what is this person doing? Do I like it? Do I want to keep hearing more of that? That's kind of what I'm going for. Even if there are some things that go wrong, it's really, that's not something focus on. But I mean, some people probably do though. So that's the thing about auditions is that you have to play the game of everyone's listening for different things. So it's really important to. That's why I try to strive to be 125%, 150% prepared. For that reason, because I want everyone's vote, and I never do.
I'd love to hear your thoughts more on collegiality because this is a very competitive field, and it is a tough mindset shift to change from I'm going for this job to now I'm in this job, and these are hopefully going to be my colleagues for the next 30 years. So I would love to hear your advice for our listeners about, the things that you have noticed that are important to you about being a great colleague.
Being super supportive is first of all, talking if there are problems, making sure that it's clearly communicated is very important. Just like kind of in some ways, even if things are a little tense on stage, which they can be, just kind of like just either focus or just maybe say something to kind of break the tension a little bit. Things like that really does help sometimes. Otherwise, I mean, I besides being the so and socially, like I want to make sure that I come to work as prepared as I can. That's the very first thing. Like, that's out of respect to my colleagues. I don't want to cause problems by not knowing what I'm doing for the music kind of thing. So, but yeah, that's really something that is something important that I think isn't taught enough in colleges in general. Like, how do you work with these people kind of thing? And that's something that's still to this day I'm thinking about and learning about. So just being very respectful is really important. And also knowing that like I might have a bad day, someone else might have a bad day kind of thing. Like it's not a big deal. Like it's like don't there's no reason to stress about it. I don't in some ways like I do take my job really seriously, but in other ways I don't take my job very seriously because I want to make sure that it's just one day or it's just one thing and it's like who cares? Like let's just move on and when I come to playing oboe, I want to make sure everything's as good as I possibly can. But I don't I try not to take it too seriously otherwise, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's good for our especially younger listeners to hear because I feel like a lot of them think, and even when I was young, I thought, oh, professionals don't make mistakes. And that's what
That's
being a professional is.
right.
And so every time, especially a professional orchestral musician says, no, people make mistakes, they miss notes, they squawk, they whatever. I feel like it's a revelation that we actually need to hear many, many times. And that doesn't mean that you don't shoot for your highest level of playing, but mistakes happen and it doesn't mean that you're not cut out for this career or that you don't have potential or that type of thing. So you talked about preparation, and part of being prepared in a job like yours has to do with reads. And so I would love to hear about what do the reed making habits look like for a principal oboist with a job like yours? And then our listeners are always interested in the nerdy stuff, like the shape you use, the gouge you use, the staples you use, all that type of gear stuff.
We
I'd
can
also
talk.
like to interject a principal oboist in a cold, dry climate.
Ah, yes.
In some ways, actually, for me, at what you're saying, the cold, dry climate, I actually do better in this climate than I do like in a wet, hot climate. I lived in Miami for years. I could not make reeds there. I tried my best. I really did. But like they never felt finished ever. So like I mean, obviously, I was able to play, but I didn't. But it never felt good. Like it was, I had to spend so much time making reeds. Okay, reed making. I spent a lot of time making reeds. There's no other way to say. Unfortunately, I remember. I think I'm allowed to quote him, but I was at Tanglewood for a summer, and Rob Sheena said to me at one point, you know it. The reed making never gets easier. It never gets easier. It's just like it's just really that was really eye-opening to me. Like I was like, oh, like do I want to do this for real? I think I am.
Rob Sheena, friend of the podcast.
Right, and I think I know he's been on it. Yeah, so But he really, I remember him, that still rings in my ear sometimes. So like, no, if I don't make reeds for a few weeks, like I have to, like I feel like I'm relearning how to do it completely. So I have to make sure I'm going ahead of myself, but I have to make sure if I'm going to take some time off that I have to have some reeds that work before going back, or else I am really screwed for a while. So okay, remaking. So I spend, whenever I go to make reeds, I always tie at least 5 reeds. That's something I always do. I don't make one at a time, because it already takes so long to make them. Why am I going to just do one when it may not even work at all? So I always tie 5 or 6 or 7 if I'm feeling ambitious or I have the time, and I get them going as quickly as I can, and I want to see like, is this going to work? Is are the is it tied correctly? Is it sealing? Is are the the sides together? When I clip it open, is it still kind of feeling like it's together? I at that point then I will. I'll try to get it to be playing pretty well, like in terms of like vibration. It doesn't have to sound great. It doesn't have to be everything, but and then I let it sit for as long as I can stand, which might be like 3 minutes, but but I try my best to let it sit for a little while. Do go to the next one and then see how that goes. And I go from there and I spend I'll get them going and then I'll try to go back the next day to then refinish to finish them some more and see how they feel. And I kind of from there, it's kind of like, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Kind of thing. And then that's kind of how I feel with reeds in general. And if things are like consistently not good, then I have to go back to, okay, what am I doing? What's wrong? Am I not? Is it something I'm doing? Is it something that the machine, that the equipment's doing? A lot of times it's me, so I have to think about that. Like, what am I doing wrong? A lot of times I'm tying just incorrectly. I'm slipping the blades not quite in the same way I'm supposed to, or simple things like that. And it's just if I'm not in practice of it, that's what happens. So, basically, like of those 5 or 6 reeds I tie, I'm lucky to get 2 or 3 that I would actually be happy with. So, that's pretty common for me. Some people have better averages than I do, but I've done this long enough to know what I can do and what I can't do. So I'd spend a lot of time on them, but I try not to waste time is what I'm trying to say. I will spend easily 3, 4 hours a day on reeds if I have something important coming up to play, or if I need good reeds or for whatever reason. So, so the equipment wise, I mostly use the Gilbert minus one shape because I haven't found any other shape for me that lets me play up to pitch. And I know that that's something that only I'm saying. I know there are great shapers,
I'm
shapes that
very
people.
familiar with the problem, though.
Oh yeah. Oh, I still am even with the shape. So I really want something at the end of the day. I want a reed that lets me just open it up and just play and not worry about it. Like that's at the end of the day. I don't care what it sounds like. I don't care what it's doing otherwise. As long as I can play like all if it feels relatively natural to me, then I'm happy. And as long as it makes a sound when I need it to make a sound, that's like half. We're almost there, kind of thing. Like if everything else, if the sound is great, that's just icing on the cake, kind of thing for me. So, I use the Furlow gouging machine because I studied with John Furlow in college, so I bought it then, and I still use it, and it's a great machine. I also have a Graf that I use a fair amount, and I use a the Antoletti a fair amount as well. So I have three. I have 4 gouging machines now. I just bought a new one. So I always have a few in case one's not working. I have backups in case. So and they all sometimes they make good reads, sometimes they don't. You just never know sometimes with these. But I probably didn't say earlier. I grew up in outside Philly, and I grew up in a town called Collins, New Jersey, which is happens to be where John Simer's shop is. I know he's John.
Ask how close you were to Simer.
I'm probably the closest person oboist to live. I'm six. I can walk to his shop. And that was not planned. That was not planned at all. My parents still live there. It's where I grew up. It's just like really funny. So I have a good relationship. I get along with him very well. We I always see him at Christmas time as well. It's great kind of thing. and he yeah, so he's helped me with these machines a lot. So it's really a great mentor for me for sure.
So have you learned how to like maintain them yourself and keep, or do you?
I need to learn more about that now. Because I haven't because I go to John. That's just
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's like one thing I'm absolutely terrified of is messing with the gouging machines.
Oh yeah, no, I will not. I don't. I'm hoping I would like to work with him at some point soon to get to learn this a little bit better. And so in case I'm in an emergency or something, I need to. But this is also why I have four gouging machines.
That's
So.
okay. My wife is a horn player, and every once in a while I'm like, I think I need a new gouging machine. She's like, what?
She's like, why? Like,
How?
we have one.
Why?
Yeah. Like, why do you need to spend $2,000 again?
Again, yeah. She's like, don't you have several? I'm like, well, I might need another one. I don't know.
I mean, as a bassoonist, I don't even totally get it. We only need one, and they last our entire lives, so.
But that's like not the same. So that's okay. No. You just don't get it. No.
I say, as the reed gets bigger, the bullseye gets bigger, and I'm happy for
Yeah,
it.
it's something. It's like I really can say now it doesn't get any easier. It really
Yeah.
doesn't. No, it's still. I really enjoy reed making. I know it's might be weird, but I kind of see it as problem solving in a way. So I really like now that I'm quote unquote good at it. Even though I'm not, but it's fun to like feel like okay, why is this not doing this? What am I? Is it something I'm seeing? Is it just feel like? Why does this look the same as this one, but this one plays great and this one doesn't? So it's like it's that kind of weird thing. And a lot of times the best reed making advice I can give at this point is really comes down to cane quality. It's really something for me. It's really important. It's something that even if everything's great otherwise, if the cane isn't what it needs to be, it just won't come out well. And I can't tell you exactly what makes good cane, like visually, because sometimes it says people's, I mean, there are guidelines, and but sometimes I have done it, I've seen exactly this piece of cane that looks great and it makes a terrible reed. So, and then other pieces of cane that look awful, they make great reeds. So it's a whole, like, it's weird. So I try not to throw out too much cane. I try to give, that's why I try to tie five, six, seven reeds at a time, even if it's not a great piece of cane. I'm gonna just, you never know, it might work. So
You recently gave a very exciting concerto performance. Can you tell us about that project?
yeah, so we me and the Buffalo Philharmonic in late January 24, we commissioned a new oboe concerto by a composer named Randall Spain. He's New York City based, and he has a fair amount of music being performed by the New York Philharmonic and I forget where else, Virginia Symphony and Buffalo here and there. So and my boss Joanne Folletta reached out to him and we kind of got this project going. And you know, it's a little scary giving a new concerto commission because you don't know what it sounds like. You have no idea what it sounds like until you actually sit down in front of the orchestra and play it. So it was really it was a lot of time thinking about like what do I want this to sound like? Like I based the page is there, I have the music, but like I can only go based on what I'm seeing on the page. I can't go to a recording on Spotify or anything. I can't just write this to see what it sounds like. So but we also we did a recording of it. So we will a live performance recording, which I think will be released in a year or two. So I'm hoping that comes out. Really cool piece. It's not written, it was written in 2023. It has no multiphonics, which is great. It's very tonal, it's very accessible and very pleasing to the ear, actually. Really well written for the oboe in a lot of ways. So very lyrical, really, really fun. So it was a nice
Can't wait
experience
to
to
hear
play that. Yeah, I can't wait to hear it too, actually. No, it's gonna be a whole project of like putting it together, like with both concerts, making sure that we get the right takes for both to make the right recording for it. So, yeah, it should be fun. So, Yeah, look out for that at some point. So.
Love that.
Awesome. Can we hear about a favorite memory that you have from a past performance?
Sure. Comes back. It goes back to early on in my career, actually. I was lucky enough to. So when I was at Roosevelt University in Chicago, I was also playing in the Civic Orchestra in Chicago, and Civic was a great place. They always, like, if there was a concert with Civic that week, we had the conductor that was conducting the CSO, Chicago Symphony, and so we got some really great conductors. And at that time, Bernard Haitink was the principal conductor. I can't remember his title exactly, but always my favorite. And we did a Schubert 8 with him, and it was just delightful. And I still think about that to this day. That really comes back to me. It's just he didn't even say anything on the podium. He just got up and conducted, and the way it was so simple but so musical at the same time. And everyone just wanted to play the best we could, and it was just a really nice experience. And I love that piece in general. So, yeah, that's kind of that sticks to me a lot. He was also one of my all-time favorite conductors of all time to work with. So, but like, it's funny. I worked with him when I was like 22. So, and it's been so long. So, but yeah. So
that sounds amazing.
It was incredible. Yeah.
If you can believe it, we've come to the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I know. It always goes by so fast, especially when we're having fun.
Yeah, seriously.
So our question that we love to end with is, what is your advice for a young musician who aspires to have a career like yours?
What I can say, it's something, this job is not easy at all. It requires, as I've been saying, a lot of preparation. You need to be, if you want to be as competitive as you can, you have to put in the work. You can't just rely on your talents, even if you have a lot of it. So it's really, especially when it comes to that audition, like you can't, like, you have to really focus on how you audition and not just about how you play the oboe, how well you play the oboe. And also to think about, like, you might want to do this for a career, but you might want to have something that would make sense to do on the back burner, like music education, which is something I was seriously thinking about a lot. Later on in my career, I was like, am I going to do this for real? I don't know. Maybe I should go back to school to get an education degree, which I should have done to begin with, which I didn't. So I should have, but just knowing that it's a very competitive field. And therefore you have to make yourself competitive in that regard too. And also to say, like, if you want to make a if you want a job that makes a lot of money, this is not the right field for you. So like, this is not, like, I'm not doing this for the money. Like, it's really, I'm doing it because I love it. That's really what it comes down to, you know. I guess that's what can I say. It's just, yeah, if you really, really, truly love it, then go for it, I would say. Yeah.
Henry, thank you so, so much for joining us on Double Reed Dish. This has been such a great conversation. We're so happy to have had this time with you.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
We hope you enjoyed that episode. We hope that you are getting lots of restful sleep, and we hope that your life is cockroach free.
And nobody's slamming doors all night long.
We wish all of this for you and more, and that you will join us for the next episode. Rate and review on iTunes, all that good stuff. And don't forget to check out the next episode, Galit, who will be joining us for that.
We had the pleasure of speaking with Allison Nicotera, assistant professor of bassoon at the University of Kentucky. Jackie, let's end this nerd parade.
Go make Reed.